Welcome everyone to the concluding session of Marxism 2018, which has been an undeniable success. Just to let people know, we've had over 1,300 tickets sold. And socialism and the increasing autumnal air is certainly dominating Melbourne at the moment. We've had over 1,100 people attend the conference over the weekend. And this has been the largest Marxism conference in many years. And I think the content of the conference has been undeniably important in the context of the world that we're facing today. Over the years, we've certainly seen multiple horrors across the globe. And over this conference, we've heard from speakers who've been suffering from Sri Lanka. We've heard from the Rohingya. We've heard from all of the struggles in the north of Ireland and elsewhere in the attempt to stand against the attempt to roll back women's rights in Ireland. We've heard about the oppression that the many activists in the Philippines and other parts of the world are facing. So we've heard many stories of horror and brutality, but we've also heard stories of resistance. We've heard stories of rebels from many parts of the globe. We've attempted, hopefully successfully, to gather together all of those stories in one place and attempt to really steel ourselves for another year of rebellion, of struggle, and of really putting up a giant middle finger to the forces of authority anywhere across this globe. The theme is rebellion across the globe, and we have three really wonderful speakers here tonight to talk to us and wrap up some of those themes from the whole of the conference. The first speaker that we have is Huwaida Araf, and I know for anyone who attended her session the other day, we were moved to tears, we were moved to inspiration. And more than that, I think that in the context of what's actually happening on the borders of Gaza, what we've seen over the last couple of days, where over 30,000 Gazan Palestinians attempted to march on the border in a brave and defiant attempt to say that they had the right as refugees, as Palestinians, to return to their homeland despite the decades of oppression. And what did they face? They faced bullets, they faced guns, and now we have over 16 new names, new martyrs in our movement. It's an absolute shocking shame, over 1,500 people injured. The media right across the world has attempted to portray this as clashes between two equal forces. And as one journalist said, they said the only thing clashing is bullets into Palestinian bodies. And so tonight, it is, I think, incumbent upon us to realise the seriousness with which we are facing across the world and the importance of our resistance. So I really encourage you to welcome Huwaida and to understand the profundity of her being here with us
man. He held up the key to his home and he said, "It's been 70 years and no one is answering us." So this man, Ali, he was amongst the tens of thousands of people, Palestinian, mostly refugees, Palestinian men, women, and children, most of who have been trapped their whole lives in an area that is no larger than a small corner of Melbourne, attempted to march towards their homes. And as Vashti said, soldiers sitting on hilltops, 100 snipers, opened fire on them like fish in a barrel. 17 dead and over 1,500 injured. 3 months ago, a 16-year-old Palestinian girl, Ahed Tamimi, was caught on video slapping a fully armed Israeli soldier who had invaded her family's property. Ahed was used to soldiers on her property. She's used to seeing her father arrested, her mother has been arrested, her brother has been arrested. She has lived her whole life under military occupation, and every week the soldiers come into her village and shoot tear gas and bullets at people protesting the confiscation of their land. But this time, on this particular day, the soldiers came onto her family's property shortly after shooting her 15-year-old cousin in the face and putting him in a coma. So she slapped this soldier. Israeli society thought, we can't be shamed like this, and went into an outrage over how she was a terrorist, and the Israeli military cannot stand for this. And so the soldiers came to her house in the middle of the night and dragged her from her bed and took her away. The Israeli military prosecutor lobbed 12 charges against her. And she's been in Israeli military prison ever since. 2 weeks ago, she accepted a plea deal. And she'll be spending 8 months in prison.
Shame.
Shame. And as horrific as her sentence was, and as unjust as it was, her sentence would have been much heavier if there weren't tens, hundreds of thousands of people that were outraged and raising their voice about it. Almost 2 million people signed a petition demanding her release. And protested. This is what you did. And because you raised her profile, the Israeli military was literally begging her attorney for her to accept a plea deal, which she took because honestly, she couldn't have got anything lighter. She could have gotten up to 10 years in prison, and she is only one of hundreds of Palestinian children. Every single year, 500 to 700 Palestinian children are taken from their homes like this and put through the Israeli military court system. They are abused, they are not allowed to have an attorney present, and then they are sentenced and lose their childhood. But again, because we raised Ahed's profile, she got a good deal, but she asked us, when her sentence was handed down, she was asked what she thought of her sentence, and she said, I was sentenced by an illegitimate court. There is no justice under occupation. Yeah. And she urges us to remember all of the other Palestinian children that didn't get the attention that she has gotten and that are languishing in Israeli military prison. Ahed has a cousin, a younger cousin, who calls herself the youngest journalist in the world. At the age of seven, young Jenna felt this burden to tell her story to the world, and so she became a journalist, trying to document what's happening, and because she spoke good English, speaking and telling what's happening in her village. And while that's very admirable, this is a burden that a seven-year-old child felt she had to carry. This is not a childhood. A few weeks ago, the Israeli military invaded one of the largest Palestinian universities in the West Bank, Bir Zeit. And they kidnapped the head of the Palestinian Student Council, and they frequently do this. Omar Kiswani, he is reportedly being interrogated up to 18 hours a day without being allowed to see his lawyer. He has not been charged with anything, and so 12 days ago, he announced a hunger strike. And I tell you this because nobody would know his name, nobody would know that he's on hunger strike, and Israel would be perfectly happy to have him brought to the brink of death. And we have over 6,000 Palestinian political prisoners. Hundreds of them are never charged with anything and yet spend years of their lives in prison. And when they protest using their bodies, going on hunger strike, resisting, they really count on us. You know, sometimes we think there's not much we can do, but just knowing that we're out there strengthens them, and raising our voices gives them power up against the military and the colonial state that they are fighting. There's a village that I mentioned in my talk, Umm al-Hiran. On the 21st of March, Israeli forces came into this village and posted eviction notices. They want to demolish it. They want to demolish it to build a Jewish town there. And they said between the 15th and the 29th of April, sometime, we don't know exactly when, they're going to come in and demolish this village. We've managed to save villages before when we've raised our voices, when we put it on social media, when we've protested. And so this village put a call out, and hopefully we will answer it and not let Umm al-Hiran be destroyed.
Yeah.
We can do it. And the people that were represented by the people that spoke to us here today about the Rohingya and those fighting in the Philippines and Sri Lanka, people living under oppression don't have a choice. They don't have the luxury to ask because this is their lives. You know, in 1990, a 10-year-old American girl speaking at a school press conference. The press conference was on world hunger. And this 10-year-old said, "I'm here because I care." She talked about the children, just like her, dying of hunger around the world, and about her dream of eliminating world hunger, saying, "My dream can and will come true if we all look into the future and see the light that shines there. If we ignore it, that light will go out. If we help and work together, it will grow and burn free with the potential of tomorrow." 13 years later, that girl traveled to Palestine to volunteer with the International Solidarity Movement, and she went to Gaza. In writing home to her mom, she said, "I'm rambling, but I just wanted to write to my mom and tell her that I'm witnessing this chronic, insidious genocide, and I'm really scared and questioning my fundamental belief in the goodness of human nature. This has to stop. I think it's a good idea for us all to drop everything and devote our lives to making it stop. I don't think it's an extremist thing to do anymore. I really want to dance around to Pat Benatar and have boyfriends and make comics for my coworkers, but I also want this to stop. Disbelief and horror is what I feel. Disappointment. I'm disappointed that this is the base reality of our world and that we, in fact, participate in it. This is not at all what I asked for when I came into this world. This is not at all what the people here asked for when they came into this world. This is not the world you and Dad wanted me to come into when you decided to have me. This is not what I meant when I looked at Capitol Lake and said, 'This is the wide world and I'm coming into it.' I did not mean that I was coming into a world where I could live a comfortable life and possibly with no effort at all, exist in complete unawareness of my participation in genocide." 2 weeks later, this girl, Rachel Corey, bravely stood in front of an Israeli military bulldozer, driven by a soldier trying to demolish the home of a family that she had been staying with. And through the bullhorn, she was talking to this bulldozer driver, saying, "What would your mom think of what you're doing?" The soldier ran her over with that bulldozer, crushing her to death. It was 15 years ago, last month, that Rachel Corey was killed, but her words live on. And one of the things she wrote home also to her mother only 2 weeks before she was killed was, "Just hearing about what you're doing makes me feel less alone, less useless, less invisible. The international media and our government are not going to tell us that we are effective, important, justified in our work, courageous, intelligent, valuable. We have to do that for each other. And one way we can do that is by continuing our work visibly." Indeed, she said, and we say, we know that we can choose to stand in solidarity with people that don't have the privilege to choose, or we can do nothing. And I know that everyone's here because we believe that we can create a better world. I know that everyone here cares, or you wouldn't be here. But sometimes all of us get tired, get disillusioned, wonder if we're effective, get overwhelmed with the daily stresses that we have in our lives. I personally was on the ground in Palestine a long time and believed that I was making change, and now I can't be in Palestine. Now I'm in the United States. And I sometimes want to bury my head under the covers. I have two small children now, and in teaching them One of the reasons I can't be in Palestine is because Israel does not let their father enter, and I don't want to take them away from their father, so we're in the U.S. But I want them to know what's happening, and that every day they have to do something to make this world a better place, even though they're only 3 and 4 years old. So one of these days my daughter was asking me about Palestine. She's 3, and I was telling her, and she said, "Mama, they took our country." I said, "Yes, they did." She said, "Well, we have to get it back." I said, "Yes, we do." She said, "We have to fight them." She said, "Mama, we have to put on our superhero costumes and fight them. And I'm Batgirl and you're Wonder Woman." Our capes might not make us superhuman, and we might not be able to fly or anything, but working together with the knowledge that it takes every single one of us to make change, and believing that we are effective, we are a damn strong force. And I'm honored to be standing here amongst you and to go forward from today, continue our work to create a better tomorrow. Thank you for being here.
Struggles from across the world, and to gather people from many far-flung parts of the world in one space over one weekend so that we can share the stories, so that we can commiserate with each other, but also so that we can learn to stand shoulder to shoulder in the future. And one of those people who we've brought over for this conference is Becca Bohr. Becca is truly an international traveller. She hails both from the United States and so has, as one of the participants in the infamous and wonderful Chicago teachers' strike, which is, was in many ways a very important precursor to the West Virginian teachers' strike, which, if anything across the world, is starting to put working class struggle back at the centre of world politics and is really shining a light across the rest of the United States and is saying that in the face of Trump, in the face of ongoing attempts to limit and curtail union struggle across the whole of that country, that people will take a stand. And so she is both there and she is also in Ireland and is standing firm and is organised on the ground in fighting back against the attempt by the government there to roll back the rights for women to gain access to control over abortion and over our bodies. So if people could please welcome Becca as our representative.
Starting with the radical walking tour that some of us were taken on, learning about the student and labor struggles and Aboriginal land here, to the different meetings that happened throughout the course of the weekend have been absolutely phenomenal. I learned a ton myself, and I'm sure everyone here also learned a huge amount and feels really invigorated to go back to our many places from which we came in order to keep struggling, talking to different folks internationally from Australia to New Zealand, the Philippines, Spain, Turkey, Palestine, etc. And just the energy and the politics have been absolutely phenomenal.
I think the image that I think of when I think of rebel is that image of the Virginia teachers holding each other's hands up in the air with tears rolling down their faces, singing Country Roads. The feeling of dignity, solidarity, unity, pride, and power. Our strength is never individual. It's only collective. When we look around the world, we see rage and pain and sorrow. We see the pain and anger in Black America, people gunned down by the police. The injustice facing refugees ripped from their homes and fleeing. The anger of millions of women who are abused, silenced, and denied their autonomy over their own bodies. The devastation of war and people fleeing their homes. The anguish of workers struggling to feed their families and to live in a society like our own. These are the realities for billions of people around the world. We live in the most unequal but the most wealthy society in world history. 50 people own the equivalent of 3.5 billion people in terms of the wealth in the society. Governments will kill, they'll disappear you, they'll imprison you, they'll starve you in order to maintain their world order. In the world that cultivates the sense of powerlessness, isolation, and defeat, the stakes are high. So we must rebel. We have no choice. And just a cursory look around the world, we see rebellion. And it comes in small places and it comes in big ways. Standing together, we can change our own story and our own feelings that we have about ourselves and about each other. Thousands of women in Ireland right now are telling their own story of their own illegal abortion, shaking off the shackles of stigma and demanding a new dawn, a new world, a new way to be treated in society. Millions of women worldwide have said, "Me too," standing shoulder to shoulder, looking into each other's eyes and saying, "I believe you." Thousands of teachers across the United States are feeling their unity, conviction, and the possibility of fighting for more. Thousands of anti-racist activists have been taking a knee and demanding hands up, don't shoot, because Black lives matter. Millions of people are discovering hope through the socialisms of Corbyn and Sanders and believing that there must be an alternative to the rot, greed, and misery the world over. And that's why these conferences are so important. They knit together the radicals, and we learn from each other, and we provide material, but also emotional solidarity and support, because we know an injury to one is an injury to all, because what we do matters. It matters to the Oklahoma teachers that the West Virginia teachers said, "Our eyes are on you, and you can do it, and you're next." It matters to the people in Palestine that people around the world are saying, "You deserve to return to your homes." It matters to Polish women fighting against a reactionary government that women around the world are saying, "We believe that you should have autonomy over your own bodies." It matters to people in every corner of this world that there's other people who say, "We see you, we hear you, and we have your back." Energize us, that help us see the continuity between our struggles across the global working class. It's conferences like these that prepare us to go back to our workplaces, our communities, our schools, and organize and fight and know that we're going to be able to win a little bit more, because we deserve to live in a world that is fit for humans. We deserve to live in a world that is worth living in. And in order to do that, we need to get active, and we need to get organized. We deserve justice, we deserve dignity, and we also deserve beauty. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Let's fight for bread, but let's fight for roses too. live right here in the marvelous Melbourne. And that's Liam Ward. All right. Funny like to be here. quite literally. Liam is a long-term activist in the Refugee Rights Campaign, and so he'll be talking a little bit about that tonight. And there was a couple of really important panel discussions which happened over this weekend, detailing not just the desperation of the situation for many refugees on Manus Island and Nauru, but also their refugees themselves struggle and the importance of their own resistance to the really brutal Australian state and regime. So if everyone could please welcome Liam.
It's always the highlight of Marxism for me is hearing the international speakers or international guests, especially on the closing panel. You know, to hear Haweda and Becca speaking really brings it home for us that, I mean, it sounds like a token thing to say, but yes, our struggle is an international one. And, you know, if you hang around the left for long enough, you hear that phrase and you hear it so many times. And when we hear people from across the world coming and talking about their struggle and talking about their resistance, it reminds us what it means to say that our struggle is an international one. It means that rebellion is everywhere and that we're in it together. And when I say everywhere, you know, sometimes you think, oh, everywhere means everywhere except here, you know, because it can seem so flat, it can seem so quiet. And I guess part of what I want to get us to think about tonight is what happens after this conference. How do we take rebellion and the spirit of rebellion out into a city like Melbourne that can seem like the world's sleepiest little town at times? Most of the time, especially if you're waiting for a bus or a train. The reality is, people know that's my Facebook fans. Look, the reality is, of course, that most of us here will never be called upon to be the next Ahed Tamimi. In Swanson Street, the IDF are not mowing us down in cold blood. You know, in Palestine 2 days ago, I mean, the blood wasn't dry from the last massacre. The blood never dries in Palestine. And it's true that we can feel like, well, that's not us. Palestine can seem a million miles away. It can seem like, well, I'm here, I get up tomorrow and I go to work and Palestine is somewhere else. And, you know, I feel moved by the struggle, but it's somewhere else. Even here, though, even here in this sleepy little town, history throws down a challenge for us. Here on this stolen land, where things can seem so, you know, on the surface, it can seem so calm. Beneath that surface, monumental horror is being perpetrated. And in fact, I mean, this is the point, isn't it? This is the horrible irony of it. Half the time, it's not even beneath the surface. The people perpetrating this horror are proud of it. They're proud of their concentration camps. They're proud of their instruments of killing. I just want to think about some of the horrors of what capitalism in 2018 looks like and just think about some of the things that we've heard in just the last few days. I mean, Becca just reminded me of the first thing I heard in the first session I went to on Friday was that stat about 50 people controlling the same wealth as 3.6 billion people. It's obscene. It's the largest gap in wealth, the largest gap in inequality in the history of humanity. And, you know, and I think about it, you think, I don't know what 3.6 billion people look like. I know what 50 people look like. It's probably the first three rows here. I don't know what 3.6 billion... It's inconceivable, the scale of that oppression, the scale of that horror, the fact that billions of people don't know where they're going to get food from. I don't know what 3.6 billion people look like. I don't know what 60 million people looks like. And I know that when we went to the session with the Rohingyan refugees yesterday morning, you know, the brave Rohingya refugees, in that session, someone reminded us 60 million people is the amount of people currently listed as refugees around the world. That's just people who have refugee status ascribed to them by the UN, you know, who are not exactly the arbiters of what's fair and just in the world. They're the ones who say, they admit 60 million people. There's a far more who are just internally displaced, who don't have somewhere to go, who are stateless. You know, who knows how many hundreds of million people are in that situation. In the session this afternoon about all the questions you didn't know you had or about something about questions. Someone else made a point in that session about And I didn't know this. Three of the four biggest companies on Earth are fossil fuel companies. Now, there's two things we can say about that. A, they have no vested interest at all in a transition to renewables, the three of the four biggest companies on Earth. And second, well, they're going to be a hell of a barrier towards any kind of transition that might be conceivable. There's millions and trillions of dollars invested in that industry, or those industries, and trillions and squillions of dollars of profit that they intend to keep wrenching out of the Earth. And they don't care about destroying the environment or destroying the planet that human beings need to live on. Another one that I think is worth dwelling on, another fact that was pointed out this morning, Chloe from Wollongong, who's a leading activist up there, made this point about, well, you might have known, in January, the Turnbull government announced that they want to spend $3.8 billion to turn Australia into the world's leading exporter of military hardware.
Shame.
I mean, that's an obscene amount just on its own. You're talking about money that could have been spent on hospitals, it could have been spent on schools, it could have been spent on a million things that don't involve killing people, for the interests of empire. And then it gets, they want us to think, like I said, they want us to think that Palestine is a million miles away. Actually, it's here. $3.8 billion. Because the reason Chloe mentioned this was that her university is already opening up avenues to take some of that money to invest it in creating research institutes that will design weapons for warfare. That means they will be designing weapons that will be used to kill Palestinians. Right? Palestine is not a million miles away. Palestine is here. Palestine is where our government is spending $3.8 billion to continue the genocide. So that, that idea that, oh, we live in sleepy Melbourne, there are people around the world who are brave heroes who are forced to rebel, who have no choice, but we somehow have this luxury of choice, that's an illusion. Actually, the battle is not a million miles away. The battle is here. And when we say that we're that our struggle is international, that's what it means. I think in the context of all that, the question isn't, why should I be a rebel? The question is, how could you not be a rebel? How can any one of us stand by and look at that? How can we look at it? How can we turn away? How can we do either of those things? We need to take a stand. That's the lesson of everything that's come out of this weekend. We should bear in mind that we're not alone, right? That the challenges that confront us are not insurmountable, and we're not the only ones confronting them. Now, I will admit, I didn't follow the West Virginian teacher strike as closely as I should have, and there were people in this room who know more about it than I do. I don't know exactly what a superintendent is and how it's different from a principal. I don't know. I don't know exactly what some scummy Democrat politician said and how a particular teacher should have oriented to that. What I do know is that those school staff in West Virginia they're struggling for answers for the same questions that we confront, and they're finding answers. How do we fight? How do we resist? How do we draw other people in alongside us in that struggle? How do we convince them that it matters that they join us in that struggle? How do we do that in situations where it can seem like all the odds are stacked against us? Right? They're addressing the same questions. They're bringing the same answers. Well, that's what it means. We're in the same struggle, and we're not alone. Surely the first step is to say, we're not going to take it anymore. The first step is to plant our feet on the earth and say, no, we're not going to stand by and let you turn our universities into facilities for manufacturing hell and horror and death and carnage. We're not going to stand by. We're not going to stand by while they normalize concentration camps. We're not going to accept that these blights on humanity, these stains on the earth, should somehow be deemed normal. We're going to resist all the way. And that's really, when I say, how could you not be a rebel, that's what it means. That the horrors that are being perpetrated right here need to be resisted, and it needs to be resisted by us, by you, by me, by us. I think there's two little codes that you might know what they mean. You might not. FRM17 and AYX18. What? Where have I gone? What's going on? This is the wrong note, something. AYX18, no, stop laughing now. AYX18 is the number that was assigned to a suicidal 10-year-old boy on Nauru. Because Peter Dutton doesn't let them have names. No Australian government, Labor or Liberal, has let the people who they imprisoned in those camps have names. When the psychologists said, this boy is at such risk of his attempted suicide so many times that it is only a matter of time until he succeeds, and that when he succeeds, his mother will probably follow, and he must be brought to the mainland for medical treatment because the hellhole on Nauru doesn't even have a proper hospital, Peter Dutton said no. And it wasn't the first time he'd done it. It wasn't even the first time he'd done it this year. FRM17 is the code that Peter Dutton assigned to a 12-year-old Iranian refugee who was also suicidal and who he also was refusing to bring to the mainland for medical treatment. Now, a lot's been made in the last week about the laudable, supposedly laudable role that the federal court has played in sort of forcing the government to allow those two children to come to the mainland for treatment. We should remember, though, that the courts in this country have never opposed mandatory detention. In fact, the High Court of Australia in 2004 ruled that that indefinite mandatory detention for life is actually permissible. Last year, the High Court ruled that it was okay for the government to deport 267 refugees who had been able to get to the mainland for treatment back to Nauru. One of them was baby Asha. You'll remember baby Asha, who was held, who was being treated in the Lady Cholento Hospital in Brisbane, and the government wanted to deport her back to Nauru. It was only because of the actions of the nurses, doctors, the medical staff in that hospital, and the community blockade initiated by people in this room that stopped that and that saved baby Asha and that also forced the government's hand, and today at least half of those refugees are still in the country. What I'm getting at there is that the laws that govern in this country and all around the world are laws that protect the interests of the powerful. They have no interest in protecting humanity. The courts that enforce those laws, the police, their concentration camps, all the way up to the High Court, these things are instruments of oppression. The borders that these people police, that their laws guard, that the High Court orders people to get out of, these things are all instruments of oppression directed at us. And we need to rebel these things in the name of humanity, in the name of basic human dignity. We need to oppose the existence of those borders, the existence of all those laws that enshrine them, and all of those laws that make it such a crime to do anything to improve someone's life. I mean, look at this country. Two of the most illegal things you could do, cross a border in search of a better life, or take unlawful industrial action in pursuit of a bit more wet money. You know, why are these two things so illegal? Like, that tells us everything about the state and the laws of this country and whose interests they act in. And it should be a message to us that resistance, it needs to be permanent. It needs to be 24 hours a day of understanding whose side we're on and whose side the laws are on, whose side the state is on, and why we need to be opposed to the whole thing and tear it down and build a world that's fit for humanity.
Just an honour, and I have to say, I cannot think of one better thing to be doing with my life than organising something with so many hopeful people, with so many people who can see that it's so important to take some time out from home renovations or from study or from visiting your parents or from whatever it might be. To actually come together and work out a way that we can challenge all of the injustices that we're facing right across the world. There's one guest at this conference, Alper Sen, who's from Turkey, and he's involved in a really important project. That project is about documenting the the history of the left and of the labor movement in Turkey in conditions of extreme repression. He said that the name of this video project is called Don't Look. And the reason it's called Don't Look is because on all of the major demonstrations that the left and that people have been involved in, from Gezi Park right through to today, the first thing that happens on these demonstrations when the police start to mobilise, they gather. And many people in Melbourne or elsewhere across Australia would know that one of the first things that the police do when they're attempting to move you on is that they gather in formation and they start to chant, move, 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 and then they start to push you out of wherever you are. So in Turkey, they say move. Then the next thing they say when people don't move, because in Turkey they refuse to move time after time, the next thing they say in formation, the next thing the police start to say is, don't look, don't look, don't look, don't look. And what Alpa said to me the other night was, the project that he's involved in, and he thinks the project of the international left, is to look. The first thing to do is to look. And I think tonight, out of everything that everyone has said, and the whole purpose of this conference in many ways is to say that we are all going to look, but more than look, we're going to also say move. We're going to say move back to the cops. When they try and get us to move, we're going to say fuck you. We're inviting you a direction. Want to see the kind of world that Liam and Huwaida and Becca described, a world that does not do the kind of things to refugees, that does not ascribe us numbers, that gives us names, that recognises our dreams, that allows us to be full, free individuals. That's what socialism is actually about. And the fight for socialism is a fight that everyone in this room, I think, should really dedicate their lives to being engaged in. So I would encourage you.